Good afternoon. On behalf of the United States Institute of Peace and the Whistleblower Initiative, I'd like to welcome you to today's discussion of the Iran-Hezbollah relationship in the wake of the one global conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. We're meeting today only a few days after the UN Security Council passed a resolution that merely to stop hostilities and prevent the resumption, but also to advance a bilateral process of peacemaking or accommodation between Israel and Lebanon, and perhaps more explicitly, to advance a process of internal peacemaking and sovereignty building in Lebanon. Yet it is far from clear whether Resolution 1701 will take hold, much less achieve its more ambitious goals. Indeed, it might collapse or might be severely weakened as a result of the conflicting expectations, goals, and interests of those parties directly involved in the conflict, i.e. Israel, Hezbollah, and Lebanon, or a result of the positions and actions of regional players who are more indirectly but decisively involved in the conflict, namely Syria and Iran. Indeed, Israel's failure to deliver a mortal blow to Hezbollah's military infrastructure and the drubbing of Israel's soldiers in their battles with Hezbollah guerrillas seems to have encouraged Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah to resist, or at least vastly complicate, the international community's efforts, as well as those of the Lebanese cabinet, to revive and strengthen previous attempts to disarm Hezbollah and to integrate it fully and peacefully into Lebanon's confessional democracy. To help us sort out this complex situation and assess its implications for the region and for U.S. Middle East policy, we have assembled, as you well know, an extraordinary group of scholar analysts. Each of our panelists will tackle a series of questions that could very well merit a full-day conference, but each of whom will have only 11 minutes at most to answer. Keeping them in line will be my mission, no easy task in that they're all friends and colleagues. We will begin with Vali Nasr, who has just published a book on the Shiite political revival, but much more importantly, recently appeared on The Daily Show. I really want to find out more about that. I've asked Vali place the recent conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in the wider context of the Shiite revival, and to consider in particular how the conflict is affecting the evolution and growth of Shiite political identity and activism in Iraq and beyond. I will then turn to my old buddy Hadi Samati, who I first met in Tehran when I was attending a conference on Khomeini, a conference whose keynote speaker was none other than Nasrallah himself. I've asked Hadi to offer us insights into the internal political debate in Iran regarding Iran's support for Hezbollah. I'd like Hadi to consider whether the current bipartisan euphoria in Tehran detracts from more lasting fissures within the political foreign policy elite regarding the purpose of Iran's support for Hezbollah, or more broadly speaking, its overall Middle East foreign policy. Then we will then turn the podium over to Kenneth Pollack, author of a superb book on Iran and its relations with the United States, to consider how the outcome of the recent conflict between Israel and Hezbollah might affect an international effort to keep Iran from pursuing a nuclear arms option. Is the international community any further from or closer to a solution? Has its influence been enhanced or reduced? And conversely, is Iran more or less likely to pursue a WMD option in the wake of events? Lastly, but certainly not least, I've asked Ray Kutke, who I should add is also the author of a forthcoming Council of Foreign Relations book on Iran, to respond with brutal brevity and precision to the three presentations, and in particular, the implications for the Middle East foreign policy challenges that Washington is going to face and is now facing as the smoke clears along the Lebanese Israeli border. Ray finishes, we open the floor to questions. So, Vali, let's yes. Good afternoon. Thank you for thanking Dan and USIP for putting this together and providing an opportunity to discuss these issues. So I think it's actually important to look at what's happening in Lebanon and the war with Israel beyond just what it means in the context of Arab Israeli conflict, and more broadly think in terms of what it means for U.S. policy in the Middle East and the new axis of power and balance of power that we see in the region. I think in some ways Iraq is a good place to begin, because the Shia Sunni issue was problematized there. What we've been seeing since 2003 is a growing specter of sectarian violence that we essentially refused to acknowledge was occurring until February 2006, when there was a massive explosion that destroyed the Shia shrine in Samarra, and since then the Shia decided to join the battle and establish a balance of terror in Iraq, which is sinking that country increasingly into an abyss. But Iraq also produced, if you would, the contours of attitudes and alliances. There was very clearly a Sunni attitude or an axis that began to emerge in Iraq. First of all, on the ground, it was in the form of the Salafis and the anti-Shia groupings led by Abu Musab Zarqawi and the like, who began not only to define the nature of violence in Iraq, but began to also impact public opinion beyond Iraq in terms of Sunni attitudes towards Iran and the Shia. And then heads of governments began to join in, first with King Hussein's declaration of a pending Shia crescent, and then, you know, culminated in President Mubarak's rather unfortunate remarks about always, almost, which means basically always, Shiites are loyal to Iran. And on the other side, what we began to see coming out of Iraq was also Shia attitudes about the Sunni reaction to them. And I think increasingly the Shiites, as they saw resistance to their greater empowerment in Iraq, they began to look for ways to go around this. I think within Iraq itself, regardless of their engagement at the center, the dominant view among the Shias is that there's not going to be a reconciliation. Coexistence won't work. And, you know, you can continue to engage in that God, but the reality is that you've got to fight it out, and which is a whole different issue. But I think within the region, it created a debate between those who wanted to follow the model that Ayatollah Sistani had put forward, which was one man, one vote, which they believed would benefit the Shiites if political reforms continue, if they follow the more sort of open leadership. And even Hezbollah, during the first year or so after the change of regime in Iraq and the elections, would constantly talk about one man, one vote. Because it's very clear that one man, one vote in Lebanon also means a certain transfer of power away from the current Sunni Christian condominium that was established in time towards the Shiites. But also, I think there was increasing interest to shift the focus away from the Shia-Sunni issue to the Arab-Israeli issue. First of all, that the Shiites would only be able to have legitimate claim to leadership if they were to appropriate the Arab-Israeli issue and the Palestinian issue successfully. And secondly, because it's useful. In other words, if Iraq's impact on the region is to emphasize, problematize the Shia and their Iranian connections and try to galvanize the Sunni identity, which is what everybody from Salafi clerics to kings and presidents has been trying to do, the benefit of focusing on Israel and Palestinians was to do the opposite. In other words, have a bridge-building means of going above this resistance. And this is a page out of also Hezbollah's strategies in the 1980s, where he got a great deal of popularity for fighting Israel, and also Ayatollah Khomeini's own foreign policy, of also focusing on the Arab-Israeli issue, at times being more anti-Israeli than the Arabs themselves, as he tried to position himself as the leader of the Muslim world. I think the Lebanon war in major ways has now sort of made this regional. First of all, it is the Sunni axis that came out and made this a sectarian issue. In other words, their understanding was that to stop Hezbollah and its influence, we need to play the sectarian card. So from Prince Saud al-Faisal to King of Jordan, they all came out trying to, in what I think is completely unprecedented, to criticize an Arab force in the middle of a fight against Israel, and to do so
not only for its behavior, but also for its identity, because it's Shia. And secondly, is the which I think is very significant, is the flurry of fatwas that came from Salafi clerics and Wahhabi clerics who tried to also marginalize Hezbollah by pointing to the fact that it represents a heretical apostate practice of Islam. And now the fact that both of these failed are also quite significant, in that the Hezbollah-Iran strategy, at least at the public domain, has worked. I mean, they successfully hijacked the Palestinian issue, they've taken over the Arab-Israeli issue, and the Sunnis, by their behavior, helped create a very clear convergence between the rising Shia-Sunni tensions in the region and the most important conflict in the region, which is the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, Lebanon's Hezbollah's performance in the war has its own implications for how this will now go beyond Iraq elsewhere. One is that clearly, and you can hear this in the Shia rhetoric in many places, the Shias have performed a lot better than the Sunnis. So they believe they've earned the right now to speak for Arabs. Pro-Iranian, anti-Iranian, end of the day, they've defended that little village far better than Saddam defended Baghdad. And that is an important dynamic which will sort of begin to continue to unfold. One of its consequences is that it puts a lot more pressure on moderate Shia leadership as we think in terms of an Iran-led sort of a Shia axis in the region. Not only because Hezbollah has sort of shown its worth in the battlefield, but also because the distress of the Shia population in Lebanon puts a great deal of pressure on the most moderate Shia leader, Ayatollah Sistani. Most of the great majority of Shias of Lebanon actually look to him as their source of emulation. He may follow Hezbollah politically, but in practice, Sistani is their Ayatollah. And he cannot remain, in a sense, immune to the distress of that community, and particularly to embrace the United States and Iraq at a time when the U.S. essentially is seen by the Lebanese Shia to be at war with them. And this favors, if you would, the more radical element whose reflection in Iraq is Muqtada Sadr. And the second issue, which is clear, which is important, is that, well, where do the Sunnis go from Lebanon? Where do they go from here? In other words, the ground that has been lost by the Arab regimes and also by the radical Sunni groups, the Salafi groups, the Wahhabi groups, having lost both the sort of heroic image of being the forefront of anti-America, anti-Israel battle, and on the other hand, the strategic ground that the Sunni governments have lost by being marginalized in this conflict, I think has within it the germs of a greater sectarian confrontation, because they've defined essentially this in sectarian terms from day go. And also their ammunition in the 1980s, 1990s, of dealing with the Shia threat always has been to emphasize on sectarianism. And I think this probably will be the first impact of Lebanon could be in Iraq itself, namely that's where there is already a battle going on, and Iraq is where you have whereas in Lebanon you have the Shia Sunni coming together under Hezbollah's mantra, Iraq is where they're actually coming apart in a bloody confrontation, so there is, if you would, an ingrained interest in deepening the cleavage that exists in Iraq. It would benefit the Sunnis if Iraq would once again become the dominant mantra in terms of shaping attitudes towards the Shia and towards Iran. And secondly, is that Lebanon itself very clearly is in danger of a major civil conflict. Now, whether particularly the American call for Lebanese to hold Hezbollah accountable. And the only way I can see it is that, what does it mean? It means civil war. It means Shiites versus the rest. Because Hezbollah's hold on that community is fairly strong. There's no light between its political control for its population. It's the rest of Lebanon, the middle class, the Christians and the Sunnis to the north, who would hold Hezbollah accountable. And if there were to be any kind of a conflict between the Shiites in Lebanon and the rest, then that would clearly aggravate the problem in that we also are seeing in Iraq. In other words, my guess is that this moment of shared semi-unity between Hezbollah and Lebanon and Gaza. And as was the case with Ayatollah Khomeini, there's going to be enormous amount of respect for the model, which was the case also with Khomeini, but not follow. In other words, end of the day, they are the Shiites. And the Sunni powers' interest would be to emphasize those differences rather than to emphasize the lesson of unity that has come out of Lebanon. So, I don't think there's any sort of signs of optimism here. I think we're sort of in a dark period where we're having one conflict following after another one in sort of enveloping fashion. And now they are all connected together through strands, one of which is the Arab-Israeli issue, one is the sort of anti-Americanism that is brewing. But also one clear strand that is now running through all of these Middle East conflicts is the outcome of the Iraq War in terms of a Shia-Sunni divide, which has obviously the Teuton elephant in this room with the Iran and how the U.S. will be able to go. Why don't I stop here and go by stage?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks very much, Ali. I really your point about this notion that the Sunni Shia sort of bipartisanship will endure only a few more weeks or whatever, I quite agree with you. I also think that look at Nasrallah's statements in the last few days. On the one hand, he talks about unity, but he's also threatening his enemies in Lebanon quite clearly and quite aggressively as well. He has a capacity to act if he so chooses. So I think your point about the sectarianism of the region and the reflection of the conflicts will be unfortunately borne out. Hadi, you have the podium.
Thank them. Pleasure to be here, and thank them. I'm grateful for I've known for a long time, and we've always been all conscientious and speculating in the and never actually could be totally right or totally wrong.
That's a nice one.
Yeah. But let me begin. I'm going to start with a bit of the internal debate about this, and not much speculate on whether you're wrong, what involved, and to what extent it was involved. Go straight to my point. During the crisis, not much I would have about the future either. From the beginning of the crisis, two broad narratives have been developed within the Iranian political establishment, both within the government and outside, at least within and at least outside. The first narrative was the one that essentially featured this as a clash of Iran with the greater Middle East plan of. It's not about Hezbollah, this is about the broader competition particularly this administration in Washington is trying to articulate. So, and they saw this as a battle that it has been forming, formation, and we should stay course, the same sort of phrase that Bush uses a lot, and they actually said if we sit fast and stay fast and remain persistent in our fight, we're going to win this battle. Defeat Israel, defeat America. This narrative was essentially offered to the Iranian public within the more conservative and radical press and intellectual circles. It was originally much more difficult to sell it wholeheartedly, but as the devastation actually became much more graphic in TVs and now satellite channels were broadcasting again, the one in TV was broadcasting too, it actually became much more of a sellable narrative. I think that narrative was sold quite effectively to a large degree, in my opinion, and my judgment is that ultimately the broad support that Iran gave to Hezbollah in this particular instance was a symbolic packaging of the images and the brutality that they foresaw to be of unparalleled in the recent conflict in the region. So this narrative that this is a large battle between Iran and the U.S., not necessarily the Hezbollah, and we have to state in state of course and find it was played well and was sold really in my judgment efficiently. The editorials and the discussions and meetings in Tehran were all involved and developed in these broad sense that you have to state the message. The second narrative was what mostly the reformist press and reformist intellectuals, and to some extent even mainstream conservative argued, that this was a strategic mistake by Hezbollah. This was a strategic blunder, and in this, essentially on two grounds. It would complicate Iran foreign policy in the region. It would essentially put Hezbollah in a very difficult position to sustain a long, drawn battle. And in essence, it would exacerbate the focus on nuclear issue for Iran. And Washington and the international community would be much more focused to deal with the nuclear program. So the second narrative, which you could see in broad, as I said, editorials and discussions, came to be very much critical of Hezbollah initially. And even then, as the crisis evolved, they had to be succumbed to this broader narrative as well. So they were taken by surprise that actually Hezbollah was putting a very, very tough fight and was winning. So it became very difficult for them to still sell this argument as the battle went on and then the station became much more clear to the public. So in these two intellectual fights about whether it was a strategic blunder on the part of Hezbollah that would put Iran in a very difficult position both militarily as a deterrence and reducing Iran's deterrence value in terms of Hezbollah's assets, and in political terms, complicating Iran's foreign policy in the region, complicating Iran's broader domestic agenda. These two narratives essentially could not sort of be equal, given the fact that the killings and the devastation are so enormous. The public, whether the public is standard, or at least student is, I think the public was initially also very reflective of the broader discussions that were going on among the intellectuals. The public was sort of ambivalent initially, but this was not a Palestinian issue per se. This was a Shiite issue. So the public became much more supportive, I think, gradually than the famous sort of victim that Palestinian issue, we should not be more Palestinian than Palestinian. This was a more substantially emotional and ideological and cultural relationship. Iran's relations with the Shiite in Lebanon had gone back 400 or 500 years. But it was very difficult for the public to stay as critical and look at it through the prism of Palestinian issue anymore. So the public, I think, in general, was supportive of Hezbollah involved, but they saw these also as a prelude to possible confrontation with the U.S. That's why you could hear resentment and critical comments in interviews and writings. Ultimately, I think it became clear to a lot of people that the way that the evolved the situation and the outcome of this crisis, in general, led to the vindication of the broad hardline narrative that we told you, and the reformers were actually put on defensive on this issue. So we told you that you can't pursue a foreign policy that is so soft, that is so full of diplomatic niceties, and is so rich. So you can't reach out, this is how you would respond. And they also had this image that essentially this was a long planned battle. It just didn't come overnight. So in that sense, I think it was a vindication of a lot of reform, I mean of radical conservative discussions and arguments that this is a prelude to confrontation with Iran, war with Iran, and going to put it all. So it led to a broad support for Hezbollah ultimately. However critical people might have been, they sort of put aside criticism and started sort of rallying on the whole notion that we have to support the program. It is, in that sense, what's going to happen in the next few months. I think Iran's position and the elite will basically be grounded in the broad battle they have had over the last 5-6 years. So this issue will not resolve the fundamental fissure within the political elite over foreign policy direction. This issue would, at least for the timing in the short term or the medium term, would put those who are favoring a more broad approach found with outside rules in a very defensive, very difficult position. So the reformists have come to be very critical of Bush administration, for its wholehearted support of Israel, and both for undermining the democratization impulses inside Iran and throughout the region, and also in terms of their own foreign policy. So on both fronts, the reformist agenda has been essentially undermined. So when they had this rally in Tehran, this meeting in Tehran in support of Hezbollah, you could see from the most secular force in Iranian reform movement to the most religious force in Iranian reform movement gathering in this mosque in Tehran in solidarity with Hezbollah and the people of Lebanon. So I think as a result of that, most people believe in Tehran at least that the strategic dilemma facing the democratization of domestic reform is actually very much entangled with U.S. foreign policy, and they've become much more critical of that. The evolving nature of the issue will depend on how things develop in Tel Aviv, in my judgment. This is my own judgment now, rather than describing the debate. How Tel Aviv will reconsider or evaluate what they did, and what would it mean for their relationship with Iran and their position. What would happen in Washington? Whether there would be a recalculation now that Iranian has demonstrated that we are a big force to be reckoned with. Whether this administration will consider its position in terms of rapport. And of course, it will depend on how things on the ground in Lebanon will go. So I think it's too early to say how Iranians would strategically benefit or miss in terms of Lebanese political scene. But I would see there's a potential that in the long term, actually this would be a win-win situation for Iran. In the sense that even if the short term military value capacity of Hezbollah has been reduced and the defense capability of this force has been reduced, I have no doubt that they are going to be rearmed, resupplied, and they're going to be a much more powerful force in a few years. Politically, they will gain and have already gained. So in the heart of Lebanon, despite all confessional differences, I would argue that the way at least people in Tehran perceive the issue is that they have a better strategic political position in Lebanon than ever. So even if the transformation within Iran Lebanese politics moves and pushes Hezbollah in the direction of reconstituting itself in a broader political term, Iran will gain. This is how I think they perceive it. This is, I think, how it will ultimately be would position Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon. To some degree, I think they have also scored a public symbolic victory in the region. Iran, at least the conservatives, have a great degree of concern about how they would look within the broader Muslim public opinion. They think, and I think the logic is true, they think they have scored a big victory in this public opinion campaign. And for that, it may end up overplaying their hands, both on neutral issue and on other foreign policy issues. So I suspect in the near term, they would sort of stay calm, they would try to sort of pull off what has been devastated politically and militarily, but will gain politically as they move along. That is my perception, and the debate within Iran about other strategic vision of Iran in the region would not be dramatically changed and shifted by this event and the war that has gone on. I'm going to stop here. Yeah, it's 10 minutes is what Dan is good at skipping, but I'm not good at skipping.
Well, I've never met any of my Iranian colleagues who would speak for less than 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's a great pleasure to be back at USIT and on such a distinguished panel with so many good friends. I have the unenviable task of discussing the American position in all of this and trying to lay out the course that I think that the United States ought to follow. And of course, I have only 10 minutes, maybe 11 if Dan's going to be nice to me. Thank you. I want to start with just some of the zeitgeist that I think is permeating Washington scene, something I think is actually very dangerous. And in particular, the assumption, what I'm hearing around Washington, I think is most dangerous, is this assumption that seems to be gaining traction in many quarters on both the left and the right, that ultimately all of these problems in the Middle East, Molly used the term that we're going through a dark period, I completely agree with that characterization, but there's an increasing sense among many people, an increasing assumption among many people, that the cause of this dark period is, in fact, the Iranian regime, that the Iranian regime are diabolical geniuses who are, at some level, instigating and engineering all of these different problems. They're the principal source of the problems inside of Iran. They're the engineers of the crisis in Lebanon. They are engineering a broader Sunni-Shia split. They are responsible for what's going on in Palestinian territory. You hear this more and more in Washington, that the Iranians are, in fact, undermining the structure that the United States has been trying to create in the Middle East. I think this is an extremely dangerous conception of what's going on in the region. First, I think it's Iranians far too much credit. The Iranians are, in many ways, every bit as incompetent as we are. And we should not believe that they are diabolical geniuses. And I know that Hadi or Najma Bozakmer, my colleagues in the audience, or Dan, or Lee, or Ray, all can attest to exactly that fact. There are some things that the Iranians are doing quite effectively. There are other things that they're doing very badly. The fact of the matter is that many of the problems, I would say most of the problems in the region, are being caused by their own internal dynamics and by American mistakes. And we shouldn't ascribe these American mistakes and these internal problems to the machinations of the Iranian regime. I think in some instances the Iranians are doing their best to take advantage of some of these mistakes and some of these internal problems, but even there, the Iranians are failing as much as they are succeeding. Again, I think it is very dangerous to have this misperception. And I see it taking hold, if you allow it to take hold, I'm going to come back to this later, it leads U.S. policy, I think, in a very mistaken direction. With regard to the nuclear program and the impact of Lebanon on the nuclear program, keeping that first point in the background, there are two issues that come to my mind that have the potential to play a role in this question of what happens with Iran's nuclear program, what happens with the UN Security Council. The first is the question of whether the Lebanon fighting has weakened the international coalition that the United States and Europe had successfully forged to put pressure on Iran and to try to force the Iranians to give up their nuclear program. The honest answer, I just don't know. It is too early to tell. And I don't think that we're actually going to know probably until the end of August, when the Iranians are expected to give their answer, and when the world will have to react to whatever answer Iran gives. Now, I'm going to come to a second point about Iran, playing off of something that Hadi said in just a moment, but I think it's safe to say I don't expect the Iranians to simply say yes to the package that was given to them. I'm not convinced they're going to say no either, but I don't think they're going to say yes. And so the question is going to become, what does the international community do with what the answer from Iran is probably neither yes nor no? I'd say before the Lebanon fighting, the U.S. and Europe had actually done an extremely effective job of forging that coalition. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. The policy, this policy of carrots and sticks, was actually working. And my expectation in June, before the fighting started, was that had the Iranians given a neither yes nor no answer, we probably would have gotten a second UN resolution that would have included sanctions against Iran. I don't know what the extent of those sanctions, but I think there would have been sanctions. The question now is, has the Lebanon fighting weakened that coalition? Listen, I don't think it's clear yet. However, there certainly is the risk that it may have done some damage to the coalition. Certainly, the United States' unequivocal support for Israel and the sense among the international community that while Israel may well have been justified, most of the international community seems to feel that while what Hezbollah did was wrong, it was illegal, it was an act of war, by the same token, Israel's reaction was at the very least, let's say, unhelpful. There is a little bit of kind of a pox on both the houses mentality out there. And to the extent that the United States was seen as enabling the Israeli response, and to the extent that this plays in other capitals as a sign that the U.S. is still attached to its old cowboy diplomacy, that could hurt that coalition, because a critical ingredient in forging that coalition was the U.S. administration convincing allies in Europe, as well as the Russians, Chinese, and other key actors out there, that the U.S. was following a very practical approach, that we've given up help with diplomacy, that we were willing to take yes for an answer from the Iranians, and at the end of the day, this was not just another charade to lay the groundwork for a war, and it's effectively what we have to put us in, as the rest of the world certainly believes we did in the run-up to the Iraq War. And again, the administration had, to give them credit, done a very good job of that. It was making very good progress. The Lebanon fighting, if it is seen as a reversion to cowboy diplomacy, could undercut that effort. And that's one of the things that I am watching for out there. The second issue, and I'm going to make this short, but as Hadi made most of the points that I wanted to make, I think is on the Iranian side. And it's this question of whether the radical hardliners are now in the ascendant in Tehran with regard to Iran's foreign policy. Since I study the feet of Hani Samati, I tend to believe there are debates that go on within Tehran, that there are different factions who have different, very different ideas. And I do think that it is the case that the Lebanon fighting, because it would be seen as a vindication of a broader hardline hypothesis that Iran should be pursuing a more active and more offensive, for lack of a better term, confrontation with the Western world, and especially if Iran is not seen as having paid a price for its active support of Hezbollah, that this may give the Iranian hardliners an advantage in the internal debates inside Tehran. What that says to me is that come August, when Tehran is finally forced to give an answer, it may be more no than yes as a result of this. Now, in the long term, I actually don't think that this is necessarily detrimental to the international efforts to end the Iranian nuclear program or bring it under control, however you want to put it. But I do think in the short term, it may make it less likely that we get cooperation from the Iranians. Again, if the hardliners are seen as vindicated because their position tends to be more confrontational on the nuclear issue as well as on these other issues as well, we could have a more belligerent Iranian answer, just a more negative Iranian response. What should the U.S. do? Well, the first point I'd make is I think that we do need to, as best we can, recoup whatever damage may have been inflicted for our unequivocal support of Israel. And there, the best thing that we can do is actually help rebuild Lebanon. And that is the thing that the international community is most offended at. Again, the international community, by and large, respects Israel's right to self-defense and understands that what Hezbollah did was an illegal act of war. What they don't like is Israel destroying Lebanon to try to get at Hezbollah. The more that the United States can lead an international effort to help the reconstruction of Lebanon, I think the more it will be able to repair that damage. And, you know, the administration certainly said the right things. The problem is that the administration often says the right things, but just doesn't do them. And I think this is one where we absolutely have to make good on our promises. It is not enough for the president to simply pledge that we're going to do these things and say we need to get it through causes. We really need to do it. A second point, I think we do need to try, as the colloquialism in Washington, they say, just split off Syria from Tehran. The more that Iran is isolated, the more that Syria is willing to help us deal with Hezbollah problems, the easier it's going to be to deal with both of these and ultimately to separate them. It's worth making the point that in many ways Syria is the bridge, both literally and physically, between Iran and Hezbollah. Several weeks ago, Phil Gordon and I called for a carrot stick approach towards Syria as well, and just today I saw that Dennis Ross had an op-ed arguing the same thing. I think this is the right approach. It's what, how we ought to defend with Syria. It does offer the possibility of really reorienting the politics of the Levant. Another point, I think the U.S. ought to be considering making some additional concessions on the Iran issue. Now, truth in advertising, I've always felt that the Bush administration had not gone far enough in being willing to put carrots on the table. Carrots for Iran in return for them giving up their nuclear program. But again, to go back to my first point, to the extent that the Lebanon fighting may have hurt the solidarity of the international coalition, one very good way to repair it would be for the administration to go a little bit further in making clear to the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, etc., that we really do mean it when we say we will take yes or an answer from Iran. And there are a number of different things that we could do that I think would have a very powerful psychological impact without really giving away the score. And I think the administration is right to believe we can't just put everything on the table right away, especially since right now all we're talking about with Iran is the nuclear program. Just some quick examples. We could offer some security guarantees. It's an easy one to do. I think it would be helpful. And again, it would send the right signal to the rest of the international community. The administration could restate, or could simply state, because this administration has never done so, its willingness to lift all U.S. sanctions if the Iranians met our concerns on opposition to the Middle East peace process, support for terrorism, and the nuclear program. This is something that every other U.S. administration, going back to Reagan, has been willing to do. The Bush administration hasn't so far, in large part because of uncertainties over exactly what it plans to do toward Iran. But again, it would be a very important gesture to make. And just a third one to throw out there, an effort at a new security architecture in the Persian Gulf, I think, would also be another welcome one. There are a lot of good reasons to do this purely from the American perspective. But again, it's the kind of thing that I think would be welcomed by many in Tehran. And again, we demonstrate that the United States is not simply determined to go to war with Iran, that our concern about Iran's nuclear program is related to a larger objective of trying to stabilize and pacify the Persian Gulf region. Beyond that, a final point, I think the most important thing that the United States can do is not throw out the baby with the bathwater. What I mean by that is to go back to the original point that I started out by making, that this misperception of Iran on the march, of Iran on the offensive, of Iran being behind every bad thing that happens, at least in the Middle East, if not the world, including the blackout in New York last month. This is taking hold, and you're increasingly seeing people talking about this and making the case that the United States needs to get more aggressive with Iran, we need to push back, we need to be ready to deal with it. Even things like Ambassador Khalilzad's remarks about the Iranian presence in Iran, I think are potentially unhelpful because they feed this larger misperception that we are engaged already in a titanic struggle with Tehran for the soul of the Middle East. We may eventually get to that point, but we're not there yet, nor do I think it's inevitable that we will. And in fact, the more that we move in that direction, the more likely we make it. And quite honestly, I don't think that that's a war that we all want to fight. I think it would be much better not to fight that war, and I don't think that we have to. And I think, as I said before, that the policy that we've had of going after Iran's nuclear program and trying to curb it using an international, multilateral approach to Paris Six was working. And this is a fight that I constantly have, again, on both the left and the right here in Washington. It's worth remembering that despite all the claims to the contrary, the IAEA actually did censure Iran, even though no one thought they were. And no one thought the IAEA would refer the Iranian nuclear issue to the Security Council, and they did. And no one thought that the Security Council would take up the Iranian nuclear issue, and they did. And no one thought that the Security Council would pass a Chapter 7 resolution, and they did. Those are all very important signs that this policy was working. We should not jettison this policy nor undermine it by chasing this false chimera of the Iranian devil behind all the problems of the Middle East. If we do that, we're simply going to lose what could be an historic opportunity to actually rein in Iran's nuclear program and trigger this war. As I said, a war which I think we'd be much better off not fighting. Thanks very much.
I would only add that if the effort to court Syria is taken seriously, it means, of course, taking the peace process seriously, raising the whole question of Israel and Syria. And that is something that seems to be so fundamental. Maybe we'll address that more in the question of time. Perhaps Ray will want to tackle this.
I'll be brief, since this might go merely to comment on something that others have harnessed. The others have said, so I might not even need much to do in minutes, but I'll see what I can do. I'll start with some of the things that Valley said, since I never like to challenge or contest anything that a descendant of prophet says. Also, with so many things. Valley painted a picture of the Middle East as sort of divided along sectarian lines, which sort of makes sense to me. However, the rational implication of that is that Middle East conflict are likely to be more durable and more state. However, once territory becomes sublimated, then it's no longer a conception, it's apostasy. So once the complex become colored by a religious overtone, then they can be very difficult to resolve. They become rather enduring, if not permanent. And if Valley is right, and I suspect that he is, that the Middle East is divided along sectarian lines, that it is religious identities that increasingly define political loyalties and international orientations, then we are looking at a Middle East that is divided along series of civil wars. Civil War of Lebanon, civil war of Iraq, and greater degree of internal instability in states that have large Shia communities, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and so on. So in essence, we're looking at a Middle East that is not just one third one, but perhaps permanently so. Does that necessarily mean that Iran is in power? In a sense, that constitutes a setback for Iran's original revolutionary ambitions, which was never to become a sectarian power. It was going to be an Islamic power, and it was the Saudis and others who insisted that Iran was a Shia power. So it constitutes at least a reorientation of Iran's international relations, given the fact that it appealed to a certain segment of the Middle East population, but by definition not others. That certainly was not the definition. Ambitions that Ayatollah the founder of the revolution had is to be a revolution without borders. Now it is a revolution defined within certain borders, but certainly one borders on by others. Fadi mentioned his fatwas that many Sunni clerics were given involved. Fatwas on the other side. The Shi'i clerics were also in their own faith to behave in a different way. And this is a rather disturbing situation. Several points that Hadi made that somewhat contest, I suppose. The division between the Iranian public, how they perceive this issue, and the Iranian leadership, I just don't think much of this. We don't have reliable public opinion surveys, we don't have this sort of assessment of public opinion. On the nuclear issue, that becomes particularly so. I did report that Iranian public is supportive and not supportive of the nuclear issue, so I'm taking a side on that. And rationalize it. And ultimately, when you take two positions, then you don't know your position. And I don't think we simply know how the Iranian public views these particular conflicts, and I would go one step further, it doesn't particularly matter. These are elite debates. They've decided within an elite category of individuals. And it is, actually, I would go one step further than Hadi. The Iranian political system is perennially factional. However, increasingly, what you're beginning to see on national security issues is end of factionalization. There's a beginning of consensus on it. You see it certainly on the nuclear issue, where, as far as I can say, there's nobody for suspension. And you see it on increasing on the Lebanon issue, where there's statements that were coming out of the reformist parties and politicians, which are generals, well, not that different than some of the statements that were coming out of the hardline bloc. So although the domestic political scene about how to liberalize the bureaucracy, how to integrate public opinion into Iran's polity are still strong, and on issues of domestic politics and domestic economics, there's ample debate. But I think increasingly what you're beginning to see on international relations issues is points of convergence and consensus, which makes the argument of President Ahmadinejad matter or not irrelevant. If there's a need of minds, then it doesn't really matter who's up or who's down. If, in fact, there is such a consensus emerging, and I suspect that there is on Hezbollah, issue on Iraq, and on terms of the approach to the United States, which is still being remarkably free of suspicion. Turning to some of the points that Ken made, I think Ken makes an extremely valid point that not everything that goes wrong in the Middle East can be attributed to Iran. It doesn't say who it should be attributed to. I suspect Iraq would have something to do with that. But on the issue of the international consensus on Iran's nuclear issue in light of the Lebanon conflict, everyone in the international community, in the European states and elsewhere, must ask themselves as they contemplate Iran's nuclear portfolio in the next months, do they want a third crisis in the Middle East? If Valley is right, if Hadi is right, and Lebanon is likely to have a slow motion civil war, and Iraq is in perennial state of civil war, then does the international community have the appetite for a third confrontation with the Islamic Republic of Iran? Or is the international community beginning to experience crisis fatigue, where we can no longer condemn so many eruptions of conflicts? was foreign policy that historically in this city and elsewhere, in terms of how to approach Iran, there was a sort of wild oscillation between calls for containment and calls for selective engagement. The question that I'd like to pose, as much as position to defend, is have we gotten to a position where neither of those two paradigms is a useful way of addressing the Iran agenda? Containment of Iran, who is going to do the containment? When the Deputy National Security Advisor of Iran says there is absolutely no evidence that Iran is interfering in his country, the traditional balance of power and rivalries in the Gulf simply no longer exist. There is no wall of containment that can be built. Iraq is a broken, fractured country. The GCC states are simply not up to it. Their practice is likely to be appeased as opposed to confront Iran. And the United States power is not just contested, but found to recede in the Gulf. So for the foreseeable future, it is hard to see the mechanisms by which Iran's power in the Gulf. It's hard to see how it's influenced the regular. Selective engagement, meaning we give you this if you give us that. I think Iran is reaching the point that the Soviet Union did in the 1960s. We will not offer concessions to get to the table. We have earned the right to be at this table as an equal power, and offering concessions and accepting preconditions is something that the weaker powers do. That is not Iran today. Security guarantees, I've been many times in favor of them, but I'm not sure if they're increasingly valid. Iranians don't ask for security guarantees. They just simply don't. When Iranian spokesperson is asked about security guarantees several weeks ago, he gives an answer. And by the third line, he's talking about giving America security guarantees. So there's a realignment of power in the region. Security guarantees from whom? Do Iranians take the American threat seriously? Does anyone take the American power seriously? So where does this leave us in terms of summary of some of the things that we have said here? It leaves us with the Middle East divided along sectarian lines, making this complex enduring, but not permanent, permanent being the duration of one's lifetime. A powerful and dominant Iran in the Gulf, impervious to offers of engagement, incapable of being contained with a mature nuclear capability, but not necessarily weapons control. Thanks.
Thank you, those very encouraging words. I knew we'd all be pretty depressed by the end of this series of presentations. We'll see if we can find some red. Especially with the audience, thank you very much, Mike. I invite you, the audience, to come up to Mike and please address your questions specifically to one or more of our panelists. We welcome brief, concise questions and we discourage political statements of any kind.
I'm Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association, President of Indian Veteran Officers Association. I heard very various opinions on it, and I would request a categorical answer to the basic question. That is, that anti-Hezbollah campaign conducted in Lebanon, did it have a desired effect for what it was conducted for? Secondly, and it's dropping near America to the Middle Eastern countries or the Muslim countries, or taken it far away. Has America also brought the unity amongst the Muslim countries of all shapes and also Israel and America? Has it increased the already existing terrorism? Will now Iran come to the table to talk to
you? Well, you have several questions.
that allows Ken and then any of those ones to respond to tackle any of those questions in any way you want. So,
okay, I'll chat 25 minutes.
Brian, let me take your first two questions. I'll leave the rest for the others. Did the Israeli campaign have its desired effect? No, it did not. It did not destroy Hezbollah. It may very well have eliminated some of Hezbollah's stockpiles of longer-range missiles, but quite frankly, that's not a terribly useful military goal. Those stockpiles can be replaced, and I think we all assume that they are being replaced very quickly. You know, the great mistake that the Israelis made, and it's kind of stunning given that they just watched us make it for 3 years plus in Iraq, was they tried to take out a guerrilla force using conventional military operations. And I think the Israelis unfortunately bought into the myth of their own intelligence. They thought they had Hezbollah so well pinpointed that they could do what we couldn't do to the Iraqi insurgents. And the fact of the matter is that it doesn't really matter how good your intelligence is. The way that you defeat a guerrilla force is by choking off its recruitment, not by killing what personnel are available now or destroying what stockpiles of arms you have. And I think it's pretty clear Israel did not do that. And unfortunately, as Ali was suggesting, they may have actually increased Hezbollah's ultimate strength by generating greater recruitment among the Shia community before Hezbollah. But again, the ultimate answer to that question is up in the air, because it will depend on where Lebanon goes. And that's where, you know, your question about the impact on the U.S. comes in. Again, the answer that I think was implicit in my presentation, but you're not going to allow me to simply remain subtle, is that this was also not terribly helpful to the United States. That said, I don't want to suggest that it was necessarily disastrous. I think that there's still an end game going on, and the verdict of history, I think, is going to be determined more by that end game than by the actual course of the fighting. What I suggested is that there are important things that the United States and Israel can do now that will allow them to ultimate victory, even though the immediate decision seems to have gone as far as it.
Is there anything else
on that?
My name is Courtney Rajan, a PhD candidate at American University, a freelance journalist writing about this for IslamOnline.net. My question is specifically, you talked about kind of half of the equation, which specifically, Mr. Pollack, kind of class this before, you talked about policy towards Iran and how that should, how we should redirect that. But what about towards Hezbollah? Do you think that there should be any engagement or just reevaluation of what the policy is and what the, and can you talk a little bit about if you think there should be a change, what that change would be specifically?
Hi, Courtney. It's nice to see you again. I haven't seen you in a while. Look, I think it's a good question. I'm not a huge fan of Hezbollah. They aren't a terrorist group. More important than that, in many ways, is I think that they are a pernicious influence inside Lebanon. Bali is absolutely right that they are representing the Shia right now, and I think that we need to recognize that. The problem is that the way that they're representing the Shia is detrimental to the overall unity of Lebanon and to the goals of the other societies in Lebanon. At the end of the day, we need to forge a new consensus in Lebanon among the different communities there. And unfortunately, the way that Hezbollah is staking out its territory is not terribly conducive to creating that kind of a consensus. So I would like to see Hezbollah taken down a couple of notches, I think is the best way to put it, because I think that as long as Hezbollah feels like it is riding high, it's not going to give up anything, and you're not going to be able to have real progress, political progress in Lebanon. That said, you know, I do tend to agree, and I think we all know what the right answer is. The problem is the right answer is really hard. The right answer is to try to empower the Lebanese government and make it possible for the Lebanese government to do what it has been incapable of doing for the last 31 years, which is provide security and basic services for the entire population. Only under those circumstances, and only when it is clear that both the countries of the region and the great powers of the international community are absolutely determined to both bolster the Lebanese government and to prevent Hezbollah to continue to function as a state within its state, I think is it likely that you will see Hezbollah integrate itself more into the Shia community, into the Lebanese political community, and become nothing more than the principal political party of Lebanon, which I think is where we know it needs to go ultimately, but where unfortunately right now it has no particular interest in doing so, having won in their own eyes a great victory over Israel through force of arms.
If I may just add that to what Ken was saying, I think one of the fundamental problems in U.S. policy is that all of it is focused on Hezbollah, but all of its impact is on a community that's anywhere between 35% to 45% of Lebanon, and that's a fundamental problem. In other words, the rhetoric of the U.S. foreign policy is organization focused, but the impact is on a community, and in fact, everything we do is to force strengthen Hezbollah as the spokesman for that community. And I think, you know, the point that Ken raised about Lebanese government and Lebanese democracy, about which the president speaks a lot, is very key, because the way we talk is as if the Lebanese government does not represent the Shia. So we're strengthening a government in which they're not really truly enfranchised. And I think that's the problem. I mean, what does strengthening the Lebanese government mean? Strengthening Hariri, we're strengthening a specifically government that essentially was cobbled together to marginalize, supposedly Hezbollah, but in practice to marginalize the Shia. So there is no political path forward that is being put forward by this administration that even would give the Shia any incentive to dump Hezbollah. And, you know, just to sort of put the old Humpty Dumpty together is really not attractive to them. And unless you give the Shiites an interest to look beyond Hezbollah, they're not going to do so. And to do so, we really need to think about Lebanon differently. It's not, and I think that's key. Otherwise, we're not going to go anywhere.
There's a fundamental doctrinal problem right now that I think is serious, and that is the discourse on global war and terror. It's sort of imprisoned every policy initiative that could happen, including the constructive. So you have this discourse at the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda that has to deal, that already created this rule and this rule, not to talk with Hezbollah, not to talk with Hamas, not to take these guys seriously, or one way or the other. You don't have to accept the way these organizations operate. But I think unless fundamentally you reconstruct or deconstruct some of these doctrinal problems that are so ingrained in Washington that it's hard to change them, you're going to have a problem. You can't just Hezbollah is part of this fabric of political life and political life. The way Hamas has been there, just the way of it has not been a failure. And I'm sure that this is going to be the case in other parts of the world if you have that ambition. So you have to come to this fundamental strategic view of how do you want to deal with the organizations that are Islamist and orientation are very, very, at least perceived to be incorruptible and have dull, connected, organized, coherent constituencies. And the U.S. tends to be actually reacting. They take one issue and crisis, respond to the crisis, go to the national, and the next one pops up, and then they go to that crisis. And it's been the case. And I totally agree with Ken that I thought Iran was the worst place in the world of being reactive all the time. But I think I'm more than nice for how you've been watching this. It's even worse here that you have this crisis not come to that. And then, if you're right, we're going to talk about the Middle East. Four issues: war in Iraq, global war on terror, democratization of freedom, and containing Iran. All of them have failed on the Middle East. That has exacerbated and consolidated the sense of power, empowerment of forces that are weak, of forces of defense. And so you have to ultimately think about that strategic issue. How are we going to engage in the whole thing?
The Islamist colleague of all this, they told me there is a movement, not quite the one we expect.
Absolutely. Sam Lewis, retired long time Iran watcher. I want to pick up on this last conversation and also something Hadi said. You said you didn't want to get into the question of what role, if any, Iran played in Hezbollah's decision. But that takes me back to a fundamental question I would love to know the answer to. Maybe one of you know. We remember how Hezbollah was created by the Revolutionary Guards as a wholly owned subsidiary years ago. We know how it's evolved as an institution very much amidst the population of Lebanon and the majority, the plurality of Lebanon's population, and increasingly dominant in that population. And we know about his leadership having evolved from one assassination to a perhaps even more successful leader, Nasrullah. My question is, how much do you believe Nasrullah, let's focus on Nasrullah and the leadership Qatar, how much influence, control does Iran have over that leadership? Because the answer to that question is essential if you think that somehow, either by American policy or other developments, Hezbollah can become, over time, a truly domesticated Lebanese political institution? Or is it going to remain an instrument of Iranian foreign policy as well, or perhaps in addition to it?
Someone used a nice analogy the other day with me, Sam, that I think is particularly helpful since you're the questioner. This friend of mine said that Iran's relationship with Hezbollah is very much like the U.S. relationship with Israel. Tremendous commonality of interests, provides arms, equipment, training, etc. Generally does consult before doing something major that could impact the sponsor's interests. But they are separate entities. And I think that Hadi is absolutely right, that the relationship has changed very significantly over time. And in particular, you know, here for me, it goes back to the U.S. policy. I see a real watershed in Iran-Hezbollah relations after 2000, after the Israeli withdrawal, when Hezbollah really started to come into its own in terms of the political force in Lebanon, which gave them an independent base, independent of Iran, and allowed them to start moving in this direction. And I think actually one of the greatest mistakes of U.S. foreign policy the last 5 years was after the Cedar Revolution, not having done more for Lebanon, which again created a power vacuum. Syria was gone, Hezbollah filled it. That again increased Hezbollah's base within Lebanon and allowed them to distance themselves further from Iran, to the point where I would actually argue that today, I think that Iran needs Hezbollah more than Hezbollah needs Iran.
I think that you have tons of arguments about the Taliban and Israel and the U.S. as whole. Iran has as much power as any major power who supports the lesser power has on it. I would say that you know, at least the evidence of some of the Iranian weaponry in the war at least leads me to think that they knew a lot more and were prepared a lot more than, so for me at least, the glass is more half full and half empty on that argument. But I think the other point you raised is very critical. Maybe one of the benefits of the engagement of Iran, it could be that you change the strategic environment of Hezbollah. In other words, I mean, you can go, when the Soviet Union was turned around, well, North Korea didn't throw the towel in, but many others did. In other words, the question is that if Iran no longer has a vested interest in a hot war with Israel, or if it's or had a vested interest in relation with the U.S., that can change all of the strategic calculation that Israel relies on. And therefore, you would think that, you know, not to say that all the problems end in Iran, but maybe the other way around, that some of the solutions lie in Iran.
Eileen
Monahan
with Congressional Conference. Hadi partly answered the question already, but I'd like to hear what the rest of you think about the subject too. You were talking with some of you about the idea that we could be facing a series of civil wars in the Middle East, and assuming that that may be true, when we look back on this period, to what extent do you think that the overarching emphasis on the idea of a global war on terrorism in Washington for the last 5 years will be to blame?
Well, I would say actually that is increasingly unhelpful, because you are lumping together conflicts that are very different from one another. In other words, Hezbollah or groups in Iraq are fighting, rightly or wrongly, over territory, over concrete things, over power, position, domination, territory. Whereas Al-Qaeda is a very different phenomenon. And its war is very different, and its use of violence is very different. And I think, you know, by lumping all of these into one rubric, we're actually confusing ourselves, and we're just sort of blunting what might be a much more effective way of dealing with it.
So the Hezbollah and the point that Rally raised, of course, raised that. And I think we have in general to all exaggerate the emerging civil wars the conflicts or religious conflicts. I do not believe that the pessimistic view of Sunni, at least Sunni Shia people, is going to be as serious as the panel tend to make the argument. I am not of that view that this is going to be a lasting conflict of the simply the person between Iraq and Sunni Shia. But I think the broader political conflict, if they are solved and if they are tackled, these are going to be sort of managed, at least managed. The Sunni Shia divide in Iraq is mostly a question of, yeah, power and sharing power in Iraq. In Lebanon, it's a very different story. Sunni Shia divide in Iraq is very different from Sunni Shia divide in Iraq. So I think they're all, even that religious ethnic divides are different country to country. You have to be careful, and then you sound very good. You have to care not to, to sort of demonstrate, or at least offer an image conceptually and analytically that this is region-wide, hunting is blurring and it's all uniform. It's not. I, for one thing, at least Lebanon, actually bridged some of the gap into the populism, if not at the region. Saudis maybe is still interested in pouring money and competing divides into Lebanon. And I think even they are going to be, tomorrow morning, they have to be really worried about broader conflicts that are going to be getting states involved. For that, and avoiding that sort of a control thing, they may have to come back at least position of the Lebanon and talk to us each other. So, better be careful not to take this conflict to war, unless if there are still possibilities that will come.
I'd like to actually go on to our next question.
Thank you. Omar Shakib, undergraduate at Stanford University and an intern with the National Endowment for Democracy. My first question is for Vali, who I had the privilege of studying with on campus this year. But your perspective very much talked through the sectarian lens looking at the Middle East. But given Hamas's success in Palestine, and they're a Sunni movement without a strong anti-Shia component, and given the electoral success of the Muslim Brotherhood across the region, but specifically in Egypt, and their pledged support for Hezbollah during the campaign, also given the general upsurge of Islamist sentiment across the region, and given the status of the governments in the region, the fact that most of the Arab governments like Egypt, Jordan, Syria are very secular in nature, whereas Iran has taken up the mantle of kind of revolutionary rhetoric and happens to be more Islamic in nature, to what extent do these events fit into the sectarian lens that you brought up? And my second question, really quickly, is for the whole panel, and it's regarding the recent report by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker, and I wanted to get your take on that, especially the aspect about it where he said the idea that the United States saw the bombing campaign of Israel in Lebanon as a possible test case for a similar operation to take place in Iran. To what credibility do you give to that report, given its success in exposing Abu Ghraib and the Madeleine massacre previously?
I'll just quickly answer that. First of all, I think we misunderstand the word secularism when we talk about the Middle East. It always reminds me of that old story about Lebanon where someone was stopped at a checkpoint and there was in front of the religion, it was blank, and the guard asked him, "What's your religion?" He said, "I'm an atheist." He said, "That's fine, but you're a Christian atheist or a Muslim." Sectarianism, and I agree with you with Hadi and Hello, has really little to do with religion. I mean, religion is underlying, but it's about power. And it's about distribution of power. What the animus comes from the exact same thing that happened in Iraq. You have Shia communities that, whether they were majority or minority, were excluded from seats of power. Demographically, you're reaching a tipping point in the Middle East where it's not possible for these regimes, be it in Lebanon, in Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, to continue to exclude them the way they did. Iraq created expectation. Half of politics is about expectation. That it is possible for change to come. To have the convergence with this issue with the rise of Iran, which secular regimes in the region, particularly those of Jordan and Egypt, came out and used the sectarian card in order to manage Washington's reaction to this, and also to rally the people on the ground to resist this. And until that sort of distribution of power issue is settled, individually in these countries, as well as at a regional level, it's likely to be there. It doesn't mean that you're going to have, outright conflict, but it's going to affect other conflicts as well. Now, it's very clear that the Arab regimes took a look at the Lebanon war, and they said, this is about Iran and the Shia. It's they who said that. It's not the Shias who said that. They never came out saying this is the Shia cause. They said this is an Arab-Israeli cause. It's the Sunnis who raised this specter, which means that, for them, this is the way they see the picture. And I think also the sharp edge of ideology, certainly radical ideology, is very sectarian. And for so long as that's the case, and as much influence as that will have, that's likely to play itself out. So we're going to have convergence of these conflicts with this issue until this sorts itself out.
You might want to comment very quickly on the latest first piece.
I'll make a brief comment, which is, Sai has very interesting sources inside, and things I've seen and heard
support his contention that there are a lot of people running around the Pentagon arguing for war against Iran and trying to fix on. And that was where my earlier remarks came from in terms of fixing on every problem happening in the Middle East as being Iran's responsibility and therefore the right address for solving all those problems was Iran. That said, it is also my very strong sense that the principals, the people who actually run this government, have no particular appetite for a war with Iran. That they understand that they have got their hands full in the crises in Iraq, in Lebanon, in the Palestinian territories, in Afghanistan. They're floundering to find solutions to those problems. The last thing that they seem to want right now is an actual war with Iran.
I would add that the desire not to go to war doesn't make much of a story.
Lal Saab, Brookings. Forgive me if I'm being unfair, but I think few ideas or focused explanations have been put forward about any of the balance on the relationship per se between Hezbollah and Iran. So I'd like to pick your brains on that complex relationship, like Ambassador Lewis has tried to do, at least from a U.S. policy perspective, and probably Ken would like to answer my question. To what extent is Hezbollah's alleged international terrorist capability an extension of Iranian foreign intelligence services? And is Hezbollah's virtual terrorist global reach a real security threat to the U.S. homeland, or is it exaggerated, if even existent? Thanks.
Oh, Bilal, you're going to pay for that later.
I know.
Let's see if I can answer those two relatively briefly. Look, you know, you're certainly right, and I think, again, it gets to the complexity of the relationship, that there are lots of different Hezbollahs. There's Hezbollah, the political party in Lebanon. There's Hezbollah, the social relief service in Lebanon. There's Hezbollah, the guerrilla organization, and there's Hezbollah, the terrorist organization. You know, they all do seem to meet at the top, and they all do seem to be very closely linked and exchange personnel, but in ways you can distinguish among them. And one of the things that I think, again, has been growing basically since the late 1980s is a sense of differentiation between Hezbollah, the terrorist organization, and Hezbollah, those other things that it is in Lebanon, where when we've seen Hezbollah undertake operations outside Lebanon, it has always been entirely under the rubric of Iranian intelligence, with Hezbollah acting as, in many cases, just a surrogate, just a hired guns for Iranian intelligence. They need an explosives expert, they get one from Hezbollah. They need a shooter, they get one from Hezbollah. Whatever they need, they reach out to Hezbollah. But in every case, it looks like it's an Iranian operation, not so much a Hezbollah operation. That is an important distinction to make. Again, it gets this question of, you know, can you pull apart? Could you give up Hezbollah, or could Hezbollah give up its terrorist operations and yet remain what it is in Lebanon? It leads me to conclude that they could if they were willing to do so, and it didn't take a lot to get them to be willing to do so. With regard to, are they a threat to the United States? In theory, yes, of course. Hezbollah is a tremendously capable terrorist organization. If they decided that they wanted to come after the United States and in the United States, my guess is they could probably do a lot of damage. We haven't seen them want to attack American targets. Actually, I should be careful about that, because again, the available evidence that we have is that Hezbollah was at least complicit in Khobar Towers. Although again, that does look like it was an Iranian operation, which Hezbollah simply participated in. But you know, I think the last time we saw more of an active Hezbollah role was in the 1980s when the U.S. was in Lebanon. So yeah, theoretically, the capability is there, just the desire hasn't been risen.
There was plenty of reports that Hezbollah was quite active in Iraq.
Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. As you all are probably aware, in Israel there's also a reassessment going on with regard to their relationship to the other Arab countries. The defense minister, he also is talking about a diplomatic track to Syria. Yossi Beilin has come up with a proposal for a new Madrid 2, and they understand that there is no, some people at any rate there understand there's no military solution to this. It has to be diplomatic, and they want to revive the moderate Arab states who have been forced into the cellar by the Israeli bombing of Lebanon to take a more active role. And it seems to me that there is now at least a discussion on the notion of creating some kind of a regional structure in which all the countries can be involved. I think that there's a problem with regard to what Ken Pollack said of trying to get Syria away from Iran. Obviously, that's something we would desire and would hope for, but if we try and work for that, maybe we will play into this Sunni-Shia problem in a way that we wouldn't like to do that, and that any regional Madrid II or wherever, whatever it may be, must also somehow bring in Iran in the periphery as a player, so that they don't feel totally isolated. Instead of going about it in a balance of power way, we should think in terms of this peace of Westphalia. What is the good of the other in this kind of a solution? A second question to Vali, if he's willing to make any comment on that. I know he was at the meeting with the president the other day, and I don't want him to say anything about what was a private discussion, but if I were undiplomatic, I would ask him, was anybody home? But not being wanting to be diplomatic, I would ask him, does there seem to be some kind of an understanding that we have to find a new direction?
Our fervent believers in here. Quick answer. Let me just say one thing. Ken and Phil, the discussion of excluding Syria from Iran, which I think is actually remarkably sensitive. And moreover, I think it's actually quite possible. The relationship between Syria and Iran is the relationship of convenience. It's a relationship predicated on similar animosities as opposed to shared common values. So in that particular sense, I think Syria is willing to disband with this Iranian alliance or exchange itself from Iran if the price is right. So in that particular sense, there is a real loss. I can tell you what Valley told me about his meeting with the president. I think I can be very honest. It's going to be a very interesting meeting, Matt.
I would assume that by trying to hear out the specialists that they are interested in at least exploring new sources of information, but I don't have any purview as to how that would translate into decision making.
I actually tend to disagree somewhat with Ray and Ken also. More harshly with you than Ken. I think Assad and Sian has done a good point. It requires a lot of leverage and offering by the West for them to lead it on. I think at this point I see it much more difficult than ever. And I think there's an institutionalized, deeply ingrained distrust for particularly this administration, and they don't trust and they don't believe that even if they do that, that's genuine. Therefore, my suspicion is that Syrians will never defect in the next 2-3 years. Unless you offer Iran or you offer a whole bunch of things that I would pay to. It's interesting to entertain, but I think they're going to cash both checks from Tehran, checks from Iran.
I do fall in between the two. I think that it will be hard, but I don't think it's impossible by any stretch of imagination. I would be willing to put the Golan on the table, but I would put a renewed peace process with Israel on the table, which I think is really what we're talking about here. Just one last point, though. You raised the issue of should Iran be part of a new Madrid process. I have no problem with that. I mean, I've always been in favor of talking to the Iranians. I think that trying to exclude them is ultimately detrimental. And in fact, you know, I've never sympathize with the administration's position that talking to the Iranians somehow gives them a concession that they don't deserve. I think that you should talk to all of these different groups. You just make it clear that before we actually give them something meaningful, we're going to make damn sure that they give us what we need.
I would just add, I'm not saying whether or not Syria would be able to be killed off, but I think the key issue for the U.S. to think about is that what is the objective? Is it to further isolate or weaken Iran or peeling off of Syria is actually a step towards normalization with it. And I think this would mean something very different. And it also goes to the point that Ambassador Lewis raised, that if this is actually also a roadmap to ultimate normalization with Iran, it would change the strategic environment in which Syria thinks about the next steps as well.
In other words, you can cash checks at both sides if, you know, ultimately this is a step towards towards Iran rather than a step to isolate it.
Yes, Joyce Karam with Al-Hayat.
Excuse me, what I'd like if we could is all three questions, put the questions on the table very quickly, and then we'll let our panelists respond.
Sure, I'm with Al-Hayat newspaper, and my question is basically about Syria. We've seen them engaged in 1996, the ceasefire. We've seen them engaged in 2000. We see their domination ambitions to come back to Lebanon. What makes you think that engaging them now would help at all the situation in Lebanon, given that Hezbollah is a strong Lebanese party and has its internal agenda and foreign agenda apart from Syria? And given that shipments have been arriving to Hezbollah, we've seen many last year that arrived through the Lebanese government, actually, and not only through Syria.
Hi, I'm Joe, and I'm interning with the U.S. Senate, and I think my question's partially been answered, but I'll ask the other part anyway, and I hope it doesn't seem too scattered, but I was wondering if you believe that this conflict is partially a result of the U.S. suffering from the lack of diplomatic relations it holds with Syria and Iran, and I was wondering if you believe diplomatic relations are essential to solving the problem, because I've heard people say that when you have an enemy, the worst thing that you can do is refuse to talk to that enemy, because diplomatic relations can be used as a tool, even though you don't agree with that country's policy. And I would also ask, there are reasons on both sides not to establish direct diplomatic relations. For example, I assume that Iran would hesitate because of the 1953 overthrow of the prime minister and anti-U.S. sentiment because of that. And also, of course, there's the hostage crisis on the U.S. side that would make them hesitate. So I was wondering if you believe that the cost of reestablishing that painful diplomatic relationship would be too costly, or do you think that the benefits would definitely outweigh those costs of possibly losing face?
Iman Musa, Jazeera TV. Two questions, basically. Do you foresee within, let's say, the next 2 years, or maybe like after the Bush administration is done, that there can actually be semi-normal, if not totally normal, relations between Washington and Tehran, if the main sticking points, which may be the nuclear issue, and I guess even the Palestine question, I think that's mostly for street credibility in the Islamic world more than, and lip service, more than actually doing something against Israel. So do you see something like that happening in the short term future? And second of all, if we just go back 40 days ago to the beginning of the war, what, from what you've seen and heard, what was the U.S. administration thinking when it supported Israel in trying to destroy Hezbollah, knowing that, probably knowing that, or at least I hope some people knew that, it's a guerrilla organization that can't be destroyed by bombing it or shooting at it, because it's an idea that even if you destroy Hezbollah itself, it will come back as another group, not called Party of God, Party of whatever, but that the idea itself wouldn't just go away and disappear. So what was it, just a domestic political consideration at the time that they had to do, or is there some other thinking going on?
I'm going to let each of our panelists respond to any of those questions in any way they see fit. They have each 30 or 45 seconds. Starting with Ray, and we'll wrap up. I'll address the question of whether or not there can be, as far as one can tell, a sort of reasonable rationalization of the relations between Tehran and Washington in the next 2 years. And I suspect the answer to that is no. One of the things that is curious that not been mentioned here is the May 2006 Secretary Rice's offer to Iran, which was offered as a very conditional dialogue. It was offered to them in respectful terms. It was not predicated on preconditions such as accepting a resolution of sovereign of Hezbollah and so forth, which actually I think was, in terms of its content and presentation, not an unreasonable offer. However, the problem that Secretary Rice has is the first Bush administration. Namely, that there is no level of trust and confidence in the Iranian leadership toward this American government. I mean, it's routine
in the United States, if you want to suggest that the nuclear issue is about, not about the nuclear issue, it's about the character of the issue. That if there's not a nuclear issue, there'll be another issue. I mean, after 5 years of axis of this, outposts of that, was the central bank of terrorism, or whatever the phrase is. I mean, to go from there to this, you have to subscribe to collective energy. You have to suggest, oh, whoops, never mind, we didn't mean it. And I don't think Iranian leadership can accept that, especially longer than what it said that this particular regime has. So there was nothing particularly wrong with that offer, and there might not be anything wrong with the forthcoming offers from the Bush administration, but there's just no confidence in the process's judgment and in its veracity and its sincerity by the other side.
Let me try to knock down a few of these. Why engage with Syria? First, don't send Syria, engage with Syria as a panacea. I don't think any of us is trying to suggest engage with Syria, that will solve all these problems. What we're saying, in fact, is you need to do all of these different things to deal with the issue of Hezbollah in Lebanon. You are going to need to deal with the support, as Ali is pointing out, of Hezbollah among the Shia population, the fact that Shia feel completely disenfranchised by the current political system. You're going to have to deal with the inroads they've made into the Lebanese government. You have to do all of these things. But if you try to exclude Syria, it's going to make dealing with it much harder. Because you're right, right now they're getting arms from a variety of different sources. You need to shut down all of those different groups. Syria is part of that problem, part of that issue, potentially part of that solution. Joe, are we suffering from our relations with Syria? We are, but I put it a different way. We're mostly suffering from the absence of a peace process between Israel and Syria. My boss, Ambassador Martin Indyk, Sam Lewis's successor, puts it very nicely when he points out that in 1993 and in 1996, again, when you had Hezbollah-Israeli conflict, because we had a peace process, the United States was able to call Damascus and say, get Hezbollah under control, and if you get Hezbollah under control, here are the things that we're going to do for you, and we'll get this process going. And it worked. In every case, it worked. It wasn't always clean. There were times it was messy. But what we're most suffering from now is that does not exist to us. And it would have been very helpful to us to have had that. And I think, again, for me, it underscores the fact that one of the great failings of the Bush administration is the fact that they never took the peace process seriously. And that has hurt us here, as it has hurt us in so many different issues. And should we re-engage with Iran, kind of this metaphysical question, I'm all in favor of re-engagement with Iran. I am a big fan of speaking to the Iranians. I never thought that it was somehow going to undermine the fabric of the U.S. Republic. That said, I think that we need to be very sanguine about what engagement can produce. As we're all pointing out, there are real differences between Iran and the United States. And I would just kind of conclude with a temporal point, which is, I think that the panel's absolutely right. This Bush administration just doesn't seem to have any interest in engaging with Iran in kind of a meaningful sense. And I think that Ray is right. It would be very difficult for any Iranian regime to engage with this administration. But this administration is going to be gone, I really believe, in 2 years. The Supreme Court notwithstanding, I really think it will be gone. We will get a new administration. And what we've typically seen is that the U.S. kind of follows a sine wave with regard to Iran, going through periods of trying desperately to engage with them, and other periods where we're not terribly interested. We just went through a period where we're not terribly interested. But in those periods where we have tried to engage with Iran, you know, my reading of the situation is that the biggest problem goes back to a point that Hadi was making before, of the fact that you've got a group of hardliners in Iran who fundamentally aren't interested in it. And even when you've had Iranian leaders who did want to engage, Rafsanjani, Khatami, the hardliners have always been able to undermine those efforts. And we have Iranians who would say things like, well, if the U.S. had just made its offer a little bit sooner, then we could have had a rapprochement. Frankly, that is hogwash. As Bob Pelletreau and Sam Lewis and others in this audience can tell you, a rapprochement takes a long time. If you think you need to jump through a six-month window to make it happen, it is not going to happen. Until you've gotten to a situation where the entire Iranian government is ready for that rapprochement, it's not going to happen.
I think actually Syria is not as important to Lebanon probably as it is to the issue of dealing with Iran. It's seen as a way of weakening Iran's regional role. And look, Syria is also important in terms of shoring up the authority that the Arab axis have lost, in other words, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt. And I think it's more, this city is more important at that level than it is, you're right, in terms of Rainy and Hezbollah.
I think that the current crisis demonstrated again that the assumption that's quite a different look at every crisis is different. And the relinking situation from relinking the situation around Palestinian issues. This crisis shows it's all linked already. So unless you really make this point, unless you really think about this in a holistic, strategic way, you're not going to be able to deal with Iran. Iran is highly suspicious at this point, and I don't think the whole notion that the Jewish politicians argue that we're not going to be legitimized, and then they would expect that Iran would join the process of the coalition, then we have some sort of rational law that is a framework, a process. It's just unrealistic. So my suspicion is that I don't expect that there will be any drastic change in the next 2 or 3 years, but hopefully maybe the day after things will change. That I'm not that sure. That the cartoonist is the one that there's a column every day called 40 years later. And one of the issues of this cartoon was that in 40 years they're going to be talking about how to approach an engaging one. And so I hope it's not that. But, I deeply believe that ultimately part of the difference here, that is that part of the solution is going to be, and I think part of the solution is going to be Jerusalem. For sure. Ultimately, you have to believe that, engaging, and if the Israelis have done a much better job in dealing with Hamas, now more than ever, this is a little, I would say, non-conventional. I think both of the one is also going to be responding close. In providing soft landing for Iran, if you had the groups that are supported by Iran, somewhat supported with diplomatic channels and recognition. So unless you come to terms with legitimate, accept the legitimacy of Islamic Republic for staying in Washington, you're not going to have this effective diplomatic. And that's something that I don't believe that this institution is doing.
Thank you, Ali. I must say, I am one of several people in this room who participated in a number of Democrat diplomacy meetings with Iranians, and that was under the Khatami government, and such as it was. And given the change in government since then, one can't be terribly optimistic about a breakthrough. Nevertheless, I think that the main message that has come through this panel is that there's a real need for a multifaceted approach to the region, and particularly to the peace process, which has been left in many respects behind. And we can only hope that this approach will be taken up by whatever administration is down the road as we move ahead. Thank you very much for the next time.